Welcome back to the second half of the Making Waves show. We're going to start with Joff Parrish on Why Pay Taxes.
Why pay taxes? This is Joff Parrish. Each year about this time, I raise that question. This year, let's start with the reader a couple months ago who notes that terrorism is defined as, quote, the systematic use of terror, especially as a means of coercion, end of quote, and provides a long list of examples, past and present, where the U.S. government has done exactly that. He then notes that under the current Patriot Act, it's now illegal to provide money to organizations that practice terrorism, and therefore concludes that as a matter of national security, he must refuse to pay his federal taxes. Now, it's unlikely that any IRS or federal court is going to agree with that novel conclusion, but a reader has a point. The bloodshed and corporate welfare in our name and with our money, and our kids' money and their kids, raises an obvious but seldom asked question. Why do so many of us pay our income taxes? It's not a rhetorical question. At the local, state, and especially federal level, we now have a political system where the low, middle, and even upper middle income people get far less back in services and benefits from the federal government than we pay in. Meanwhile, the extremely wealthy, the top 1%, get far more. Military spending, non-military corporate welfare, and interest on the national debt alone account for more than 60% of the discretionary part of the federal budget each year. The impact of how this money is spent is even greater when considering how much money isn't in the budget in the first place because of what the rich don't pay. Corporations and high-income folks are getting more tax breaks and loopholes each year, while already inadequate social spending continues to be gutted. So why do so many of us ordinary folks pay our taxes? 230 or so years ago, this was called taxation without representation, and we threw out the government. Today, we vent our frustration by laughing along with tax day jokes on late-night TV, and revolutions are something that bad people do. But what if we refused? The federal government in particular is vulnerable. The income tax system is based on voluntary compliance. And the IRS, though fearsome in its media-assisted reputation, is essentially a very large, and not always very efficient, collection agency. It isn't a Freeman or Posse Comitatus type question of the legitimacy of taxation. Quite the opposite. It's specifically because portions of everybody's labor should contribute to the collective well-being of the community that our current tax system is ethically bankrupt. The issue here is where the money is going, how it's being spent, and how the spending decisions are made. People struggling to pay the rent, who can't afford health care, have no job security or retirement prospects, can't find affordable daycare, college, or anything in between for their kids, and so on, are tithing 30% or more of our income to people who often pay little or nothing, reap a disproportionate share of public benefits, and already have enough yachts and private luxury jets to get by. There are a few folks saying no, or tax resistors refusing, for reasons of conscientious objection, to fund militarism, and often redirecting that money to socially useful programs instead, have been painfully aware for years of how much of our tax money goes to killing. Others refuse for libertarian reasons, a larger number choose to live under the taxable income, and still more folks, when forced to choose between enough food to feed the family in April and paying the IRS bill, choose to forego hunger. As usual this year, there'll be small groups of people leafleting or protesting at post offices around the country. You'd think there'd be millions. Resisting taxes has risks, of course. It can be done symbolically, withholding a small amount here or there. It can be done with an expectation of ultimately paying more in interest and penalties, the extra cost of refusing to cooperate willingly. Or it can require major life changes to find tax-free employment and become uncollectible. Nobody should undertake tax resistance without understanding the risks, but there are also risks involved in passively cooperating with their own fleecing. And it's simply amazing that more of us don't look closely at which risk is greater. From KBCS, for the Pacifica Network, this is Jock Perry.
Next, we have labor news with another view of the American economy.
This is labor news. Information about most of us.
You can find us on the internet at labornews.us to listen to archived editions of our program. We receive emails at labornews.podcast@gmail.com. Write to us with comments and ideas. A British view of the American economy. A report from the English newspaper The Observer. A shocking 37 million Americans live in poverty. That is 12.7% of the population, the highest percentage in the developed world. They are found from the hills of Kentucky to Detroit streets, from the deep south of Louisiana to the heartland of Oklahoma. Each year since 2001, their numbers have grown. Under President Bush, an extra 5.4 million have slipped below the poverty line. Yet, they are not a story of the unemployed or the destitute. Most have jobs. Many have two. Amos Lampkins has work and his children go to school. But the economy, stripped of worker benefits like health care, is having trouble providing good wages. Even families with two working parents are often one slice of bad luck, like a medical bill or factory closure, away from disaster. The minimum wage of $5.15 an hour has not risen since 1997, and, adjusted for inflation, is at its lowest since 1956. The gap between the haves and the have-nots looms wider than ever. Faced with rising poverty rates, Bush's trillion-dollar federal budget recently raised massive amounts of defense spending for the Iraq War and slashed billions from the welfare programs. The Observer provides the following data. The United States has 269 billionaires, that's with a B, the highest number in the world. Almost a quarter of all black Americans live below the poverty line. 22% of Hispanics fall below it. But for whites, the figure is just 8.6%. There are 46 million Americans without health insurance. There are 82,000 homeless people in Los Angeles alone. In 2004, the poorest community in America was Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. Unemployment is over 80%, 69% of people live in poverty, and male life expectancy is 57 years. In the Western Hemisphere, only Haiti has a lower number. For a brief moment last year in New Orleans, Hurricane Katrina brought America's poor into the spotlight. Poverty seemed on the government's agenda. That spotlight has now been turned off. Cynthia Duncan, a sociology professor at the University of New Hampshire, says, "I had hoped Katrina would have changed this more, but unfortunately, it hasn't." This was Labor News. Information about most of us.
My name's Tom Cranker, and I'm a jolly banker. I'm a jolly banker, a jolly banker, am I? I safeguard the farmers and widows and orphans, singing I'm a jolly banker, a jolly banker, am I? When dust storms are sailing and crops they are failing, jolly banker, a jolly banker, am I? I check on your shortage and bring down your mortgage, singing I'm a jolly banker, a jolly banker, am I? When money you're needing and mouths you are feeding, I'm a jolly banker, a jolly banker. I'll plaster your home with a furniture loan, singing I'm a jolly banker, a jolly banker, am I? If you show me you need it, I'll let you have credit. I'm a jolly banker, a jolly banker, am I? Just bring me back two for the one I lend. A jolly banker, a jolly banker, am I? When your car you're losing and sadly you're cruising, I'm a jolly banker, a jolly banker am I. I'll come in foreclose, take your car and your clothes, singing I'm a jolly banker, a jolly banker am I. Cotton and times they are rotten. I'm a jolly banker, a jolly banker am I. I'll come down and help you, I'll rape you, I'll scalp you, singing I'm a jolly banker, a jolly banker am I. A jolly banker, a jolly banker am I. A jolly banker, a jolly banker.
That was Pierce Woodward and the other Jolly Bankers singing the song Jolly Banker. And next we bring you some people's history, our history, to look back on, remember, and be inspired by. We'll be hearing from Michael Parenti with To Have or Not to Have on the Upward Shift of Wealth Distribution, on the Increase in Inequality and Greater Privilege for the Few and Greater Hardship for the Many.
This is Radio Truth, a series of commentaries by Dr. Michael Parenti. Michael Parenti is an activist and internationally known award-winning author and scholar. His recent books include The Assassination of Julius Caesar and Super Patriotism. His latest book, The Culture Struggle, will be released in November 2005. For further information, please visit his website, michaelparenti.org.
To have and have not. All of humanity can be put into three groups. Group A consists of that tiny portion of people who own the bulk of the wealth in America. About 145,000 people who are the absolute super rich. They don't work because they don't have to. They receive the bulk of their money from dividends on stock investments, interest payments on bonds and securities, the sale of appreciated holdings in commodity futures and real estate, rents on income property, payments on privately financed loans or mortgage notes that they hold as creditors, and they also make enormous sums from government business subsidies and other government giveaways, royalties from oil and other mineral deposits, and various other investments. Some prominent tycoons who preside over vast financial empires may in fact work, but they do so out of personal choice, not economic necessity. And the workday they put in does not explain the source of their immense wealth, nor the pace at which it accumulates. The far greater portion of their fortune comes from the ownership of assets that directly or indirectly engage the labor of others. Now, most of humanity is in Group B. Group B consists of those who live principally off wages, salaries, bonuses, fees, commissions, and pensions. Group B includes a wide income spread, from affluent professionals who have to work because they can't live exclusively off their investment earnings, to working poor who have no net assets and endure real deprivations. Generally, what the people in Group A and B have in common is that they both live principally off the labor of the people in Group B. Group C comprises the most desperate millions throughout the world who've been forced off the labor market and who live in absolute destitution. Their political function is to be castigated and scapegoat as social parasites. Their economic function is to provide a surplus of needy workers at home and abroad who help glut the labor market and depress wages. They make up what Marx called the reserve army of labor. While asserting that the poor create their own poverty, ruling elites pursue policies that take from the needy and give to the greedy. So we have lower wages and lower salaries for the people in Group B, with greater earnings for top corporate executives, shareholders, bondholders, and others in Group A. We have a growing and more regressive tax burden for Group B, with multi-billion dollar tax cuts for Group A. We have deep cuts in human services for Groups B and C, but ever-increasing government services, protections, and contracts for big corporate business in Group A. In the United States, most of the people living below the poverty level, including many homeless people, actually work. If they're poor, it's not because they're lazy, but because they're being paid poverty wages while facing exorbitant rents, regressive taxes, and very high costs. In our society, the line between the poor and the working class is becoming increasingly blurred. High-paying blue-collar employment has all but disappeared, but in its place are millions of new low-paying jobs. Often the wife in the family now brings in a second income, a low one, to make up for the male breadwinner's drop in earnings. In addition, numerous white-collar occupations have been eliminated or downgraded, including medical personnel, middle managers, technicians, and other professionals. When employees are de-skilled, they're also disempowered, being more replaceable and thus less able to negotiate conditions of employment. As profits have achieved record levels and stock prices have surged, the great mass of working people have seen their wages stagnate or fall, while many of their benefits have been reduced or eliminated. In the last 20 years, the real income of a U.S. male worker with a high school diploma has plunged by 30%. This means greater inequality and greater privilege for the few and greater hardship for the many. This is Michael Parenti for Radio Truth.
This commentary was produced by the LA Sound Posse and may be freely copied and distributed.
And now for Between the Lines, independent radio out of Bridgeport, Connecticut.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present journalist and author Robert Scheer, who considers the consequences of a U.S. attack on Iran as the Bush administration is now reported to be considering, along with possible use of tactical nuclear weapons. Mark Potok of the Southern Poverty Law Center, who examines connections between anti-immigrant activists and extreme right-wing and racist groups. And Mathis Vakernagel, co-creator of the Ecological Footprint, who discusses how his measurement tool helps cities and nations evaluate their impact on the world's resources. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Bush administration has decided to refuse to run for a seat on the newly created United Nations Human Rights Council in an election set for May 9th. According to diplomats and human rights groups, the move stems from strong opposition from UN member states to the abuses linked to the U.S.-led war on terror, such as the treatment of detainees at the Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq and the long-term detention of enemy combatants at the Guantanamo naval base in Cuba. As an Asian diplomat told the Interpress service, if the United States contested and lost, it would have been a resounding slap in the face for a country which is a self-styled promoter of human rights but justifies abuses in the name of fighting terrorism. A nation must win 96 votes in the General Assembly to win a seat on the 47-member Human Rights Council, which has replaced the often discredited UN Commission on Human Rights. On March 15th, the U.S. voted against creating the new council, joined by three other nations, Israel, Palau, and the Marshall Islands. Congressman Tom Lantos, a key human rights advocate in the U.S. House of Representatives, denounced the decision. In a statement, Lantos, a California Democrat, observed, "It's a profound signal of U.S. isolation at a time when we need to work cooperatively with our Security Council partners." Jacob Zuma, former deputy president of South Africa, is facing prosecutors in a trial in which he is accused of raping a 31-year-old woman who is HIV positive. This in the country which has the highest number of HIV infections in the world, with over 5 million persons living with the disease. During the trial, statements made by Zuma angered AIDS educators, who fear his comments undermine the fight against AIDS. Zuma, a popular pro-labor leader of the African National Congress, who while deputy president was the head of the National AIDS Council, asserts that the woman was the initiator of the sexual encounter. Taking the stand in his own defense, the former deputy president admitted that he engaged in unsafe sex with the woman, a family friend and AIDS activist, while she was staying as a guest in his home. In court, the state prosecutor, Sharon De Beer, asked Zuma, who can still run for president of South Africa, why would you take that risk? Zuma answered that he usually uses a condom, but did not have one on the day of the encounter, which he maintains was consensual. He also explained he believed the risk of men contracting HIV from women was minimal, and that he took the extra precaution of showering immediately. Vicky Tallis of the Gender AIDS Forum, a South African-based NGO, said statements like that can throw years of hard work down the drain. Zuma was forced to resign from his position as deputy president last summer amidst allegations of corruption. Once popularly favored to succeed President Thabo Mbeki, a longtime rival, Zuma's corruption trial will begin in July. The debate over global warming on Capitol Hill changed direction in early April as top executives for energy and utility companies called for mandatory limits on the emissions of greenhouse gases. During a day-long hearing before the U.S. Senate's Energy and Natural Resources Committee, David Slump, the marketing director of General Electric's energy division, declared GE supports congressional action now. Big energy and power companies are facing growing pressure from state-level global warming initiatives, including a plan for mandatory caps on greenhouse gases in California. The hearing was the result of an initiative by Energy Committee Chairman Senator Pete Domenici and ranking Democratic Senator Jeff Bingaman. In February, they issued a paper calling for industry and environmentalists to comment on the details of a cap-and-trade program for carbon emissions. Last year, Bingaman pushed a climate change bill that would have slowed the increase of global warming gases. John Stanton of the National Environmental Trust was impressed with the level of debate. As he told the online environmental magazine The Grist, it was remarkably devoid of climate skeptic malarkey that usually derails the debate at these sorts of events. You had real experts making real progress. Still, many green lobbyists worry that enacting the Bingaman bill could delay making real reduction in greenhouse gas emissions for 5 to 10 years. A carbon cap-and-trade bill will not be considered until early 2007. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
Just days before Iranian officials announced to the world that they had successfully enriched uranium needed to fuel a nuclear power plant, Seymour Hersh in the New Yorker magazine and the Washington Post reported that the Bush administration is actively planning a military attack on Iran's nuclear research facilities. Although Iran's president, Ahmadinejad, has stated that his nation is only seeking technology to build a civilian nuclear power program, President Bush and the European Union have been pressuring his government through the International Atomic Energy Agency and the UN Security Council to halt all nuclear research. The Post and the New Yorker articles indicate that as the U.S. steps up surveillance of Iran's infrastructure, plans are being drawn up for a range of military options, including a limited airstrike aimed at key nuclear sites and a more extensive bombing campaign designed to destroy an array of military and political targets. Both accounts report that Pentagon planners are considering the use of a bunker-buster tactical nuclear weapon, such as the B-6111, to destroy hardened facilities that are buried underground or under mountains. President Bush dismissed the reports as wild speculation during an appearance at Johns Hopkins University on April 10th. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with journalist and author Robert Scheer, who for 30 years covered politics for the Los Angeles Times. He considers the possible dire consequences of a U.S. attack on Iran.
I always place a lot of confidence in anything Cy Hersh does because he's turned out to be right so often. I mean, he's probably the best investigative reporter we have. And particularly at a time when people like Woodward and others are giving investigative journalism and Judy Miller, you know, giving it such a bad name, Cy Hersh is still there, you know, digging. And I'm sure, as he describes it, there is a faction in the government that thinks you need to take out this nuclear facility, which everybody seems to agree is about a decade away from producing anything. And that the only way to do it, because it's under so much hard rock, they say they would need some tactical nuclear weapons. Well, that crosses the threshold that probably dooms civilization if you cross that threshold, because this was my whole argument with George W. Bush about winnable nuclear war and with Ronald Reagan about his Star Wars plan. I mean, once you cross that line and you say these weapons are usable and they can be used for some civilized purpose, that's a line we did cross in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but then we pulled back from it. And once you cross that line and you treat these weapons as if they're just normal weapons, you know, it's very, very dangerous and opens the door to madness. Hirsch has at least one witness well-placed, and I'm sure is well-placed, who has confirmed this. So my feeling on Iran is, first of all, I wonder whether this administration can do anything militarily against Iran without causing Iraq to just go crazy.
Yeah.
Because after all, you know, these people in Iraq now, the leading political forces in the Shiite side, Sadr and these other people, have said they would defend Iran if attacked. And so, you know, the idea that somehow you can now go to war with Iran while at the same time you're trying to work with these people to build democracy in Iraq is nuts. And it just shows, again, that we don't have adults watching the story, that there's a lack of seriousness.
The Bush administration's implicit threat that they may bomb Iran to destroy their nuclear research capability and maybe a weapon system down the road, you know, is the very thing that Iranians, if they want a nuclear weapon, that's the prime motivation, to protect themselves from an attack. They believe North Korea probably has not been attacked because they have a nuclear weapon, and they say they do. What lesson does it teach to attack Iran with nuclear weapons, except you better get your own, Jack, or you're going to be wiped off the face of the map?
Well, and also we're sending out mixed signals. I mean, the fact is we had a boycott going against both Pakistan and India. Now, with Pakistan, we've accepted that they were the main proliferator in this period, and we don't hold anyone accountable. This guy Khan is sitting there under house arrest, and that's it. And we are now collaborating with India because we say, well, they're a democratic nation, so they can have these weapons. Well, the fact is the only people that have used nuclear weapons to kill people is our democratic nation. You know, so that's not going to cut anything with people. You can't have it both ways. You can't wink at one nation's nuclear development and then say you're going to go to war against another. And what you certainly should not do, we've lost all credibility on this issue, because who's going to believe U.S. intelligence on Iran? Who knows what they have in Iran? Is this another case of the aluminum tubes and the Niger yellow cake? You know, why should anybody believe this administration about what's going on in Iran? You know, so at least this time there's a little bit of an attempt to follow the lead of the United Nations and other countries. But still, you know, this administration has played loose with the most important issue, dealing with the survival of the species. And that has to do with the development of these horrible weapons. And I would say that you're absolutely right. What we're doing, we're saying is, you know, we think these weapons are usable, and what's more, we have a double standard, and we can go ahead and develop them, and you can't. And, you know, what does that tell the people in Iran? If they're really nationalists and they care about themselves, they'll say, well, why one way or another, we ought to get one of these so we can be treated as formidable and they can't walk all over us. And, yes, I agree, it has exactly the opposite consequence. Basically, you don't have the sense of adults watching the store. That's what's really scary here. You get the sense of it's almost like a game, you know, and we won't be held accountable, and what can we get away with? And, you know, and you just watch Bush at his new kind of meetings with the public, and the smile has become a smirk. I don't think it's working, but he's still out there, you know. If I just roll up my sleeves and I look like I'm energetic and, gosh, golly, gee whiz, everything will turn out okay. And I could see with that kind of logic, okay, Iraq didn't work out, but let's do something even better for my legacy. Let's go into Iran, a country three times as large, a country with clearly some significant number of people committed to this religious fanaticism, and let's see if we can't inflame that further. You know, it's extremely, I guess the word reckless is the word I would use for this administration. But, you know, you just wonder, why haven't the Colin Powells spoken up publicly? You know, why? I mean, these people know better. He's the one that warned, if you break it, you own it. You know, he was against this. He knows they lied about the key. They got him to lie for them. When are we going to have these responsible citizens do what Joe Wilson did and a few others, you know, have done, and stand up and say, wait a minute, you know, this is really dangerous. It's serious stuff. And you're creating big problems for this world well into the future. you know, that's what's alarming here, that we don't have adults watching the store, and we don't have, you know, people are worried about their careers, whether they're in journalism or they're in politics. They seem to be more worried about, you know, their income or something in than the speaking lecture circuit than they are about getting the country right.
That was journalist Robert Scheer, author of the book Playing President. Read Scheer's columns at his new online investigative website, www.truthdig.org. In a series of giant protests demanding fair treatment and legalization, hundreds of thousands of immigrants and their supporters marched in more than 130 cities around the U.S. on April 10th. A few days earlier, Dallas, Texas, saw more than 500,000 people come out for one of the largest protests in Texas history. The unprecedented demonstrations that many observers believe proclaimed the birth of a new civil rights movement were triggered by provisions in legislation passed by the Republican-controlled House of Representatives that will make undocumented immigrants and those who assist them felons. Negotiations over other more moderate measures being considered in the Senate made little progress, but will be taken up again when Congress reconvenes after the Easter recess. Although 63% of Americans surveyed in a recent Washington Post ABC poll reject new laws that would criminalize undocumented immigrants already in the U.S., members of groups like the Minutemen have been accused of acting as vigilantes and stirring up racism and xenophobia around the immigration issue. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with Mark Potok, director of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project, who discusses connections between anti-immigrant activists and extreme right-wing and racist groups.
We began to see about 5 years ago real conflicts coming up in particular in Southeast Arizona, which because of the federal government essentially really slamming the door shut on the border in both California and Texas, has become the kind of one major crossing point from the south into this country. Of course, a terribly dangerous crossing across the Sonora Desert. Way back then, at the very beginning, we saw some of the traditional kind of anti-immigration groups or immigration restriction groups like FAIR, the Federation for American Immigration Reform. We saw officials from groups like that at very small meetings in Arizona, even in Alabama where I am, and other states, many of which were also attended by unrobed Klansmen. So we saw at the very beginning of this a kind of scary mixing of more mainstream immigration restrictionists and people who are really in our world, Klansmen, neo-Nazis, and so on. You know, that has continued. I do not mean to suggest that all anti-immigration groups or all people involved in the recent Minuteman groups, you know, are secret Nazis or unrobed Klansmen, but a lot of the leadership does have those kinds of relationships. We just put out an investigative report that looks at essentially the main leaders of this movement, 20, 25 people. And while you cannot say that, you know, all of them are racists, straight-up racists or white supremacists, what you can certainly say is that a great many of them are racist or certainly bigots. You know, it's really about Hispanic immigration, brown-skinned immigration for them as opposed to any other kind. In addition, a lot of people in this movement are extremely, basically paramilitaristic. They're a bit like the militias of the 90s. They're quite fascinated with guns. They want to go down to the border, you know, armed with AK-15s and God knows what else, and somehow stop, you know, what is depicted as a terrible threat to our society, an invasion and so on. And the last piece of it is that most people in this movement are subscribers to a kind of fantasy conspiracy theory, the so-called Plan de Aztlan, which is supposed to be a secret plan by the Mexican government in league with American-born Hispanics, that is to say Chicanos. And what they're up to is, you know, making plans to recapture and reconquer the American Southwest, make it a part of Mexico. You know, of course, there's nothing to support. I mean, there is no such conspiracy. But, you know, it's these things working together, the racism, the guns, and the conspiracy theories that really are extremely worrying.
What are the connections between the Minuteman and other anti-immigration groups and the congressional Republicans that have marshaled through the House of Representatives some pretty draconian legislation that would criminalize the more than 11 million immigrants who are in this country without documents?
As far as the relationship of the Minutemen and groups like the Minutemen to some people in power, I think that is a very worrying situation and one worth talking about. I am thinking in particular of a congressman named Tom Tancredo. Tancredo is a Republican from Colorado, and also a man who was viewed, I think, even within the Congress up until 9/11, as very much an extremist sort of fellow. Listeners may remember this is the guy that called not so long ago for the bombing of Mecca, among other things. Tancredo ran a fairly extremist caucus called the Congressional Immigration Reform Caucus, which had about 6 or 7 members until 9/11. Today it's got something more on the order of 80 people. What's worrying about all this is the following. This is the way Tom Tancredo talks about illegal immigrants, undocumented workers, is quite amazing and not that different from the way, say, you know, some of our Nazi groups talk, for instance, about the Jews. To give you an example of what I'm talking about, Tancredo told an audience recently that illegal aliens, quote, are coming here to kill me and kill you and kill our families. That just strikes me as an amazing statement. This is from a U.S. congressman who is describing literally hundreds of thousands of people as crossing this border in order to kill us. You know, it's also obviously, I think, defaming, you know, the 11 million or so people who are here, you know, the vast majority of whom, I think any sensible person understands perfectly well, are here to make a living. You know, this is just propaganda. And the frightening thing, as I've said, is that a lot of the worst propaganda is coming from people like Tom Tancredo, a U.S. congressman.
What can people do to expose and counter the racist and xenophobic message regarding immigration that's coming from groups like the Minutemen that we've been talking about tonight?
I think the best thing for people to do is to join the debate locally. This is a debate that's raging all over the country. It's quite amazing. I think that the temperature has changed very significantly in the last few weeks. You know, we have seen in the last few weeks two absolutely massive pro-immigration or pro-immigrant, if you will, demonstrations. That, I think, was quite unexpected and has also affected the ongoing kind of debate within the Republican Party and in Congress in general. I mean, I suspect there's no prospect at all of 11 million people being deported from this country, no matter what certain people may say when they stand up before the TV cameras. Nevertheless, I think it's a movement that presents a lot of dangers to us as a society, and I think that people need to simply get involved. I think it's an important debate, and as members of a democratic society, we ought to know something about it.
That was Mark Potok, director of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project. Contact the Law Center at area code 334-956-8303 or visit their website at www.splcenter.org. Worldwide human population is on the rise, and the demand for resources is increasing even faster. In the current situation, a tool called the ecological footprint is one way to measure how much land and water humans need to produce the resources they use and to absorb the waste they create. Using internationally accepted measurement tools, it's been determined that humans need an average of 4.5 acres or footprint per person to meet those needs. But in the U.S., the average footprint is 24 acres. Thus, it would take 5 planets to meet humanity's resource needs if everyone consumed as much as the average American. Ever larger footprints have led to a situation in which humans are consuming almost 25% more resources each year than can be regenerated annually. And that doesn't even take into account what resources non-human life forms require. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Mathis Wackernagel, the co-creator of the Ecological Footprint. A Swiss citizen now living in Oakland, California, Wackernagel recently visited Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut, where he gave speeches and workshops on how to utilize the tool. He maintains the method provides objective measurements, which then can be used by governments or non-governmental organizations to evaluate the impact of their city, region, or country on the world's resources.
The wealthiest Americans with very large footprints, they love to go to Italy. And in Italy, the footprint per person is about 2.5 times smaller than the U.S. average. And not because they are particularly virtuous ecologically speaking, just because they have inherited cities that are very efficient in terms of being compact. You can walk around, people eat more local food because it's available in compact cities, and you can have markets, etc. So all these things, just structurally, without every day's intentions, just allows people to have very high quality of life at much lower resource consumption or footprint, as we say. So I think that the first attention really needs to go towards how can we build infrastructures that will support efficient lifestyles, high quality lifestyles at low footprints. People often ask me, what should we do to reduce our ecological footprint? And they, I think they expect to say, drive less, eat less meat, don't eat chocolate. I don't know, things like that. And what I tend to say is, I think just maximize your quality of life. Because if you really think about quality of life, what does it take to use your budget on this planet best? Your budget is probably, for an individual, it's time, really. It's how many hours do you have on this amazing planet? How do you want to use your hours? Do you want to use it to focus on how you can maximize your income? Then you can not even spend it because you don't have time to spend it. Or is it really to fulfill your dreams, and then you can find other ways? Perhaps money is not a limiting factor, it's really time. And then people, if they really start to think about quality of life and what's the purpose in their life and how where they are most happy in their life, most people will come to the conclusion to change their lives in a way that at the same time also reduces footprint. So it's really, I think, quality of life can be a driver, and most likely you will find that the resource consumption you depend on is a barrier to higher quality of life, not an enabler.
Can you say more about, you know, how this approach can be useful in promoting, say, environmental justice around the world, or within a country and around the world?
I think what we do first is provide analysis and say that's the way it is, so we have a basis for decision making. And what we will see is that ecological assets are very differently used in different countries and very differently available. Like, for example, the Dutch, they have a very dense population, a small country, so they have little biological capacity per person. It's the way they historically developed, that's where they're at right now, and they still use significantly more than what they have, so they run a relatively significant ecological deficit, meaning they depend on either importing extra capacity or depleting their own assets. They are wealthy enough that they're able to import a big part of that difference, and so they're able to kind of not degrade at the same time their own ecological ecosystems. Now, other countries like Rwanda, they don't have the economic means to import more than what they have available locally. So as they start to use more, it leads to liquidation, like, for example, deforestation or erosion of agricultural capacity or whatever form it may take. So we just help to show where countries are at, and I think that helps strengthen a more fruitful dialogue between countries. And what we have seen, for example, is that in the last round of the Biodiversity Convention, which brings together most countries of the world, the United States is not part of it, it was the Russian and the Brazilian and the Colombian, all countries with significant ecological capacity. And again, that doesn't mean that they use their ecological capacity very effectively or they use it sustainably or whatever. They just have a lot. And they recognize that the footprint actually is an important asset for them to point out that they have assets, and that puts them in a much stronger position in international negotiations than, let's say, Switzerland, that doesn't have much available. And so they have proposed ecological footprint as a measure for biodiversity, to say we need to recognize ecological assets, and by recognizing it, I think they get also more valued on both sides, those who see their deficit as a liability or as a risk factor in their economic performance, but also those who have, they recognize perhaps this gobbling up this reserve may be the stupidest thing I can do. Actually, having a reserve is their one of their biggest assets that separates them from the crowd and gives them a competitive advantage in the future. So I think from both sides it leads us in the right direction of saying ecological assets matter, we need to preserve them, we depend on them.
That was Matthias Wackernagel, co-creator of the Ecological Footprint. Contact the network by calling area code 510-839-8879 or visit their website at www.footprintnetwork.org. Visit www.ecofoot.org to take the Ecological Footprint quiz and see how many planets your lifestyle requires. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
Thanks for listening to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice. The Making Waves crew is Amy Antonucci, Steve Capron, Steve Diamond, Tom Jackson, Stanley Longstaff, Joanne Paradise, and Damon Thomas. We welcome your participation too. Please email us at nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com to get involved. Our theme music is by New Hampshire women's drum group Tabalat, and our mid-show music is Evening Stars by Alice Gomez. You can live stream our show on Saturdays from 2 to 4 if you're not in range of the station by going to www.wirenh.com. Remember that WSCA is growing and hoping for your membership and participation. www.wscafm.org to join and learn more. Tune in next Saturday from 2 to 4 for our next Making Waves program.
That will be our Earth Day show, and we'll be focusing on alternatives to our current practices for getting energy and treating our environment and our world. We leave you with this excerpt of a poem by Wendell Berry. Every day, do something that won't compute. Ask questions that have no answers. Plant sequoias. Say that your main crop is the forest that you did not plant, that you will not live to harvest. Say that the leaves are harvested when they have rotted into the mold. Call that profit. Prophecy such returns. Put your faith in the 2 inches of humus that will build under the trees every 1,000 years.